Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Oxford Martin School. My name's Charles Godfrey, the director. I'm going to hand over in a moment to our Master of Ceremonies this afternoon, Ricardo Suarez. Ricardo runs our program in African governance. But just before doing that, I'd like to add my welcome to the Minister, the Right Honourable Andrew Mitchell, who's managed to find time to come up today on Budget Day, which we are very grateful for. And actually, I think it's Andrew's second visit here. We had a wonderful program in which Andrew and Margaret Hodge discussed issues around money flow and development. And I would also very much like to welcome the Ambassador of Portugal to the United Kingdom, who's in the audience this afternoon. So with no more ado, let me hand over to Ricardo.
Thank you, Charles, and welcome everyone. In November 2023, the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office launched an international development white paper setting out areas for action across a broad range of development themes and policy areas. The white paper does not include new spending commitments, but it is the first UK white paper in 14 years. It marks a turning point after the turmoil created by the 2021 aid cuts and the earlier Foreign Office Department for International Development merger. Do we still call it a merger? Is that the technical expression? In particular, the paper provides a meticulous diagnostic of current challenges, especially in regard to climate change and the way in which geopolitical rivalry threatens to prevent coordination to address this and other pressing agendas. The white paper recognizes the increasingly contested world we face with a more complicated and fractured environment, as well as the imperative of learning to navigate these challenges. Today's discussion will consider how to mobilize additional resources for impact when fiscal and political conditions in the UK and traditional donor partners are unfavorable, how to work with new and emerging donors and balance the need for more funds against the UK's commitment to its values. We will also discuss how to maneuver in the context of the wide choices of finance now available to most recipient countries, often with very different terms and conditions than those put forward by the UK. And finally, we will look at how to balance a focus on climate mitigation, which is primarily a concern for middle-income countries, with finance to tackle extreme poverty and climate adaptation, which is primarily the focus of the least developed countries. In order to do so, we are delighted to welcome Andrew Mitchell, the Minister for State for Development in Africa, to the Oxford Martin School, to discuss the best way to address these challenges, as well as seizing new opportunities. Andrew Mitchell was appointed to his present role in October 2022. He was previously Secretary of State for International Development from 2010 to 2012. He was elected Conservative MP for Sutton Coldfield in 2001 and had a long and distinguished career in Parliament and government before that. He is joined on the panel by two distinguished Oxford academics, both of whom have vast experience in the development policy arena. Emily Jones is Associate Professor of Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government and the Director of Global Economic Governance Program. Her research examines the political economy of global trade and finance, and she's currently leading a research project on digital trade. She's a co-founder and co-director of the Trade and Public Policy Network, which seeks to foster engagement between academics and UK policymakers on trade, and recently served as a specialist advisor to the Trade Select Committee in the UK Parliament. And further to the right, Stefan Dirk is co-director of the Oxford Martin Programme on African Governance, as well as of the Oxford Martin Programme on Systemic Resilience. He is professor of economic policy at the Blavatnik School of Government and the Economics Department, and director of the Center for African for the Study of African Economies. Between 2011 and 2017, he was chief economist at the Department of International Development. He has also served as development advisor to the Foreign Secretary. So without further ado, I would ask the minister to come to the lectern to deliver his remarks.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and it's wonderful to be back at this great school in the heart of the second greatest university in the world. I love coming to Oxford, and I've spoken in this hall before. Indeed, I've spoken with Stefan in this hall. I helped launch his brilliant book, which, if any of you haven't read it, it tells you that the most important single ingredient in development is leadership. And it's a great read. Also a great read is the white paper. Can I ask how many people in this room, put up your hand if you have seen the white paper or read it? Not bad. I mean, I'm obviously very biased, but I think that the 143 pages of the white paper are a real page-turner. I think it's impossible to put down, but for those who do find it possible to put down, there's a Richard Curtis-inspired 17-page, which sets it all out. And the great thing about the white paper, it's been unbelievably well-received. We never, in our wildest expectations, as we worked flat out for 4 months to try and put it together, we never, in our wildest dreams, believed that it would get the reception it got. Nearly 500 people in Church House for the launch in London, and also the strong endorsement by 20 heads of government and heads of agencies, and also very considerable endorsement by the sector. And as those of you who are part of or who know the sector well will know that that of itself is pretty unprecedented. Not an easy group to please. And the strength of the white paper, I submit to you, is that it is all party. It has got the endorsement of the Labour Party and indeed of the SNP and of most of the Liberals. Not that there are very many Liberals, but it's got the endorsement of at least some of their people on the front bench. So it's all party. And of course, that really matters, because if it hadn't been an all party paper, firstly, these brilliant officials across Whitehall would not have engaged with us. Secondly, it wouldn't have endured. So I think this is a paper that takes us to 2030. It will, at least in theory, survive the unlikely event of a change of government when the general election comes. I think that it's very helpful to get a bit of stability, because, as everyone in this room knows, development is long-term, and the problem with the merger and the cuts in finance is that those are short-term measures which lead to short-term effects and mean that the taxpayer actually does not get value for money for development. In the white paper, there is the... at its heart, it's how do you get the SDGs back on track. At this halfway point, they're way off track to 2030. And secondly, the subject of this meeting, which is basically how you ramp up very significantly the amount of finance going into climate change, addressing climate change, and in particular adaptation. And it talks very much, very easy to do mitigation projects in India. You can get the finance for that. It is the adaptation in poor countries which is really required. And Britain has taken up the co-chair of the Green Climate Fund. Our Prime Minister announced a $2 billion replenishment for the Green Climate Fund. And part of that is we want to support the new executive director. And we want to make sure, as I told her when I first met her, that we see adaptation projects going ahead in Somalia, because that is the acid test. How do we do that? And also it launches, the white paper has a strong section on humanitarianism, where next financial year we will spend £1 billion pounds, but also a new fund, the Resilience and Adaptation Fund, which I very much hope will be copied by others, which says this: when you are dealing with a disaster, whether it's an earthquake or a drought or a famine, you want to try and make sure that these awful events, next time they hit, which sadly they will, that there's more resilience built into the system, so that if you're moving water to an area by lorry, by water bowser, next time you want to ensure that there's more irrigation, there's more water retention, more reservoir capacity. And of course, when humanitarians deploy, they won't do that. They will seek to use whatever funds and support they've got to ensure that they meet the need. The Resilience and Adaptation Fund is 15% of anything that is spent in a humanitarian disaster, allows for that separate process of resilience and adaptation to be built in. Now, to the key points of this afternoon's discussion, I think. We are trying to find the Holy Grail. And the holy grail of climate finance, turning billions into trillions, is this. You need to take the statist money, that is the Multilateral Development Bank money, the DFIs, in Britain's case, BII, undoubtedly now the leading DFI in the world. You take the statist money and you link it with the private sector money, and in particular, the $60 trillion of pension fund money, which, if it understood the risk, if the risk could be alleviated or quantified very clearly, if they can see that they're going to get a return, many of the people whose pensions are managed want them to spend money in this area of climate finance, but they want to ensure that they don't lose their money and that they get a reasonable return. And that is why the marriage of the statist money, which can do this, to the private sector and pension fund money is so very important. And we've been working closely through the brilliant team at the World Bank that we have there, young and very dedicated, who the president of the World Bank uses, I think, quite a lot as a sort of cabinet and a think tank, using through them to try and find devices, which mean that the financial engineering and knowledge which exists across the multilateral banks is brought together to maximize what they can do with their own balance sheets. My favorite example is that if you cut the capital adequacy for the IBRD balance sheet, if you cut the capital adequacy from 20 to 19, that means they can lend an extra $4 billion every year. And if you take it down to 18, that's $8 billion. You can't obviously continue that process all the way, or it wouldn't work. The ratings agencies wouldn't be happy. But there are lots of things they can do, and we are seeking to make them do it. And once they've done it, the Prime Minister made clear at the Indian G20 that we would be happy to be part of a capital increase. We want to see hybrid capital deployed. We want to see more guarantees used. And we want to see disaster risk finance used. All of these things will help the MDBs scale up. And if you look at BII, to move on to the DFIs, BII, of course, investing risk capital, no loan involved here, risk capital. Last year, £750 million in Africa. We want them to do more in the least developed states. And so they are charged in the white paper to go up from 37% to 50% investment in the least well-off countries. And the Foreign Office is deploying through a whole range of different mechanisms. My favourite is FSD Africa, which is helping to build core capital market infrastructure in Africa. There's IXL, there's Mobilist, which is producing a listed pipeline, which Stefan will remember very well. We're trying to find ways of lowering the cost of the exchange risk, deepening local capital markets and mobilizing domestic savings. And if you look at the flow of remittances across Africa, which dwarfs the flow of aid and also direct financial investment, you can, I hope, see what I mean. So that is, I think, my contribution, my opening contribution. My time is about up, I think, now. But just let me add a couple of things. We are very clear in the white paper about the need to address debt issues in the aftermath of Gleneagles and HIPIC. We don't want moral jeopardy and all of that. So we're very keen to make sure that the G20 mechanisms and other mechanisms are enhanced to address debt issues. Britain has pioneered and marketed these special debt clauses, climate resilient debt clauses, which we launched in Paris last year, which give people a two-year break when there's one of these awful events in terms of repaying capital and interest. They need to use their liquidity for their own people. And we need also to attack the flows of illicit finance, which, alas, London and the overseas territories and crown dependencies are all too often complicit in, and to champion the Lusaka agenda and the agenda on localism, which my colleague Samantha Powers in USAID has said so many wise things about. We understand that for development to work really well, partnership, localism, the Lusaka Accord principles are vital to get effect. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for your opening remarks, Minister. Emily?
Thank you very much, and it's lovely to be with you all today. My background's very much in trade and economics, so I'm going to speak to that. But I'm also going to speak mainly about the ways of working. And I wanted to fix on the phrase that you use in the white paper of patient and mutually respectful partnerships, which is absolutely vital, and I really fully underscore that. Actually, when I started, my first job was actually in DFID in the early 2000s, working on partnerships in Brazil, with the whole notion that actually partnerships and genuine partnership needed to underpin development. And it's hard. It's hard when you're in a donor-recipient relationship to actually have create those partnerships that are genuinely long-term, are genuinely respectful. So I had a few comments. I wanted to actually take us into some terrain I think is not always the most comfortable, but actually is where we need to think about working collaboratively together. And here I really commend your cross-party initiatives to really think about how do we situate the UK 20 years out so that actually these long-term mutually respectful partnerships are absolutely the foundation. And I think paradoxically here, what we see globally is a huge shift in global economic power and the global order, a much more contested terrain. We see the rise of China. New development partners have come up. So, you know, if you're a developing country, you're looking out for development partners. There's a real choice to a much more choice, which means that then for us, we do need to have a really good offer. We need to be there to make sure that we are, a go-to partner, which actually creates, I think, some nimbleness and creativity and some opportunity for us. What might that look like? I think there's a few things. I think here I want to just think about where are there opportunities for mutual interest and actually really genuinely working in a collaborative way with developing country governments, because the UK and those governments have got a shared interest. And here I think at this particular juncture in the global system, when multilateralism is really under threat, really building that system, and I think to some extent re-envisaging that system for a multipolar world with a lot of disparate tensions, is a really important one. So I commend very much leaning into that multilateralism and helping to bring and make sure that the larger players in the global economy are also doing their part. So I think absolutely leaning in there. Perhaps the bit that's been a bit of a pinch point for us in the UK is making sure that then we're upholding that commitment to international law and a sort of principled-based approach right across the piece. And I think here, we can perhaps open up the discussion, but it's making sure that cuts right across in all that we do, whether that sort of respect for international law, human rights, et cetera. So again, making sure we're making the case, I think, domestically for that values-based, principle-based international engagement, which is the second thing I wanted to mention within this was thinking about those pinch points. So in any partnership, it's making sure that both partners are prepared to adjust where there are frictions and tensions. And here I think we've done a huge amount historically. I think some of the points you made just then about illicit financial flows and acknowledging London's role there and actually being prepared to then act, I really commend you on raising that right across the board. Because again, it's thinking about what can we do at home that actually is not always easy, but really again shows that we're prepared to be in a genuine partnership. In the trade space, I think again, which is the portfolio I follow most closely, at the moment, there's quite a disconnect between our trade portfolio, which tends to be a little bit more thinking about short-term opportunities, and actually some of the very important conversations that are happening in FCDO about diversifying that trading relationship that we've got and building it for the long term. So again, joining up then, I think, the trade offer and the development offer becomes quite important. So making sure we're making the case across the piece for development. The third point I wanted to make is around the respect. And here I think there's a really interesting question about how do we build respectful partnerships and the huge value that we have in the UK of having a large number of people from developing country, the diaspora, here living and working in the UK. And as you've said, it's they're the ones sending all the remittance flows that actually massively then outnumber and outweigh our ODA spend or our foreign direct investment. So they are the de facto ambassadors of the UK, if you like. They're the channel and the mechanism through which that support flows. And we've got a huge amount of expertise and long-term relationships, not least in this room as well. So how do we capitalize on that, not only within government, so making sure those people are really in FCDO, but facilitating those day-to-day. And again, here, I think, making the case for the contribution of migrant workers and remittances within the UK domestically as well. I think it's not, again, an easy moment to do that, but I think we're making that case and showing that respect, again, super important. Again, that cross-party area. And finally, it was just the patient, the long term. And here I really wanted to commend the cross-party nature of the white paper and all the work that you've done. Because I think the risk is the sort of short-term politics driving the day and undercutting some of that long-term planning and that long-term focus. The more that we can embed a longer-term planning within Parliament and across parties and sort of embed that, I think we're then able to look to the long-term and have those relationships that span and the projects that span sort of 20 years and aren't sort of hijacked or sort of vulnerable, if you like, to the political moment and changes that that brings.
Thank you, Emily. Minister, would you like to address some of those points or...
Would you want to? I think we should hear from Stefan first,
okay.
Really.
Okay, good.
He's an expert on this stuff.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Look, first and foremost, having left FCDO before the minister came back, I very much welcome, you know, all the work that's been put in and the idea of trying to bring a vision around development back together. You know, it's maybe very appropriate that it's Richard Curtis who writes the summary because, you know, maybe when it comes to development in the UK, it is Love Actually after all, and an attempt to actually do a bit of that because it was difficult times and a real concern that people that were working in the development sector, but not least inside the organization, working through the merger, the cuts. I mean, these were difficult times. So, and I do know, and I will want to compliment the minister definitely for it, is that, you know, it is a change of mood inside the organization relative to what it was before, that actually there is a sense of, okay, there's a role for the UK in development and to play, you know, and there's lots of other things still there, and of course budgets are tight, but there is at least somehow, and I definitely know from my former colleagues that there is a bit of a motivation again of trying to actually build this. There are challenges, and so let me put up a couple of things about, well, where I think the proof will be in the pudding about the white paper and a lot to do with how it will be implemented rather than what the ambition is. Okay, and so, and of course, it's going to be over time and it's going to take time to what it's done. And just to make sure, and my comments are very much to be seen in the context of, look, the time, for example, that I worked in DFID and afterwards in FCDO, but definitely the DFID time, and I will go back, say, maybe even to 2000s or even the 1990s, there were rather benign times for development. Okay, so there is a relative simple world order. There is not a big multipolarity. There is clearly a beginnings of progress in the world, but also, you know, things like MDGs and then SDGs, a kind of a commitment to do things. And actually, we should just recognize it that a lot of the time, the last few decades, have seen this quite dramatic progress in extreme poverty and the reductions of deprivation, whether it's health deprivations or extreme poverty. Since 1990, it's two-thirds down. And it's combined with, actually, for the first time in history since the, I think it's the 17th century, where developing countries are beginning to, in their economies, back converging to living standards, very still slowly, but on average converging back, growing faster than Western economies. So call it a benign period, and a lot was achieved. So we're now getting here now, and I would say, you know, some people say 2015, others would say 2020, but definitely in that latter part of the 2010s, a change in the world's structures, okay? First of all, you know, we have multipolarity emerging, different forces playing, and of course, the battleground to RDs typically of geopolitical forces is in the developing world, and it's definitely in lots of poor places. We get scrambles for natural resources again, and not just from one party that used to be called by the last minister I had to serve, malign forces. But there is an element of, you know, there is something there going on. But arguably, we need rare earth materials as well. We need the materials for climate change. We need to pay attention to natural resources in a way that maybe, in different ways, we didn't have. So there's the multipolarity, there is that part of it, and of course there's the climate crisis. That actually in a lot of the progress in development, somehow or another, that was not the big part. And I would say these two things, and I want to just for a moment on make three points then substantively in terms of, you know, where will the proof be in the pudding, so to speak, for the things. There's many more areas that I'm sure some of you will want to talk about. So the first of all is, let's pick for a moment up on the climate crisis, okay? So clearly, you know, we know the developing world hasn't caused it, but we need to therefore be part of the movement that tries to help them for the transition and make it very just. But of course, one of the problems is, and I should have added, the need for finance that the ministry is alluding to in a big way, of course, comes also on the back of this, you know, the massive finance that will be needed for the transition and to putting countries on a path that is sustainable. Now, it has though one problem, and the problem is as follows, that if you think of the urgency of where we need to work on this, is in the fastest growing economies, because if basically, as Nick Stern tends to say, you know, it's in Asia that the future of the planet will be determined. They're growing very fast, and if we don't get the right infrastructure, whether it's energy infrastructure or other infrastructure there in place, and find a way of partnering with them on doing this, and indeed, finance will play a big role in it, it needs to happen there. Of course, I'm someone, and I will fully admit to it, that comes entirely out of work around poverty, and as a poverty economist, the concentration of extreme poverty is in Africa. And so the geographical challenge of where the focus has to be is very different now, because the multiple objective we have, which is, you know, partnering with Asia so that at least we can use and find a way that they go fast enough in the transition, relative to where the extreme poverty is and where I need to work, is definitely going to be there. And so we need to have an answer of how we're going to handle this. And I don't believe, as some people have said, I think that Mr. Banga has said it, as the World Bank, you know, there are no trade-offs between poverty and climate. No, this is the one that I describe. The concentration of poverty is not in the first places where we need to make sure that the climate, where the climate is not going to destroy the planet. Of course, we can do adaptation, but then we may have to remove resources away from mitigation. And so there are trade-offs. You know, I'm an economist. There are trade-offs. We can't deny it. And we'll need to think through it. And I just wonder, and it's, I think the white paper needs to find a way in its implementation in that sense. The second thing is, very quickly, is that what does it look like, a white paper like this, from a poor developing country? I typically have, say, maybe African countries in mind, but it could be Bangladesh, it could be Nepal as well. What does it look like when you see this? Okay. And now the main thing is that it looks quite all right, but if I'm sitting in Lusaka or in Accra or in Addis Ababa, it's a different situation than many of the ideas that were evolved and emerged in it than it was 15, 20 years ago. I have choice. I don't have to look at you. I can look somewhere else. So the whole idea of something that want to be, you know, an element of value-driven, of normative aspect of how you do development, you're facing in a world where there's choice. And to be honest, if I was a minister in a government in Accra or in Addis Ababa, I would welcome the choice I have. I would welcome that I have a choice. And so this is actually in a bit like, okay, how do we make the offer we have beyond finance really attractive enough in terms of what we can offer? And that does mean something different from what I experienced also working inside the system, where maybe it is the interest of the country, maybe has to have a bigger weight than the kind of mutual benefit. You need to be willing to offer enough that actually it's really beneficial. And that actually this idea, and which I worry about, I was recently in Brussels, for example, language around the Global Gateway. I'm not saying the white paper does this, but around Global Gateway, it's all about driven by national politics in the end in Europe as well. We're going to do partnerships, but clearly because it's in the interest of firms in Europe and so on. Now, it's possible, but you have to work it through very carefully. And the balance between, am I going to, in the short term, promoting your own national interest, whether it's from security or prosperity point of view, or for votes in the Security Council, or am I generally going to offer something, is a hard job and you need to work through. And I have the final point, I have the moderator looking at me very sternly, is the final thing. Remember where the concentration of poor people is. Who are the partners there? Okay? Fragile states, yes, that's a very euphemistic state. I would say there's a lot of extreme poverty, typically in countries where those in power don't really care about poverty, where we have elites that actually have very different objectives and largely staying in power. Look at many West African countries. I don't think it's just in itself benign. Now, who are the partners and how you do it? If you need to go and partner for natural resources, if you need to go and partner for geopolitics, or are you going to need to partner because of poverty? And it may contradict. And I do think there is work to be done by the department to really think in this context, how do you work in these fragile places, where actually maybe the objectives of those in power is not necessarily aligned to it. How do you partner? How do you work? Are you working around it? But no, you need partners. You need to have ownership there as well. And how can you encourage generally the group that actually, you know, you can support those who want to actually positive change in their places without patronizing, without imposing, and how do you actually do partnership in these kind of maybe not so benign places? Thank you.
And I've counted at least 7 very interesting questions that both of you asked the minister, so you may not be able to address all of them in one go, but I'm sure they'll recur with this audience as well when we open up the conversation. So, Minister.
Well, let me. Can you hear me all right? Yes. Let me have a crack at some of those points. I mean, you know, I've commented on the merger. Of course, I'm now a poacher termed gamekeeper. Many of the things I said about the merger when it took place are not repeatable in a family audience. But my job, the Prime Minister said to me, can you see if you can make things work? And what we've been trying to do is to have within the Foreign Office, an entity which can deliver global public goods into the 2030. That's the sort of aim. To see if you can build something which has the strengths of DFID, and also gains from the Foreign Office. And of course, I remember very well at DFID, there were issues we wanted to do, and I had to go and see the Foreign Secretary and say, you know, will you allow your brilliant network all around the world to champion this? And one of the things that the Foreign Office really has internalized, very impressive, is the importance of girls and women in development policy. I've always argued that you cannot understand international development unless you see it through the eyes of girls and women. Everyone here will know what I mean by that. The Foreign Office really have internalized that point. But equally, you know, when I got back there, I discovered 2 things in particular. One of which was, I may have said this when I was here before, but it was like meeting people who had coming out from the rubble of a nuclear explosion and who were very, very disenchanted indeed. And who, you know, remembered that DFID had been able to make the weather, you know, when DFID had such good connections all around the world, we could really do things, and that the merger had damaged that very, very gravely. And of course, there's no such thing as a merger. One side always wins and one side always loses. I learned that many years ago as a young banker in the city. So, you know, there are real issues there. I tried to address a lot of them in the Chatham House speech I made in April last year, where I sort of tried to deal with the structural stuff, and the white paper seeks to deal with the policy side. And of course, the process of the white paper was very beneficial because the development people there were 13 people who wrote the white paper with me. And a lot of us, you know, we worked for 7 or 8 weekends on the trot to try and get it right. So it lifted the spirits of the development silo within the Foreign Office, but it also intellectually engaged these Foreign Office officials and officials across Whitehall who saw what the development people could do and engaged with it intellectually. So that itself was a very good process, but we've seen a very stark diminution in capacity within development, wherever you look, whether it was in humanitarian, where there were an enormous number of vacancies. I mean, about half, a team of 80, were down to below 40 in that. And then, you know, the results, which we championed so strongly in the earlier phase of this government, you know, there was no one at all doing results. No one at all. So the key thing you have to show the British people, if you want them to support a big development program, is that they're getting value for money. If you haven't got people doing results, you simply can't do that. Then the whole thing is compounded by a point that you made, which was that for the first time in my lifetime, the international system is shot. The rules-based system, because the Russians, a member, one of the P5 at the UN, invaded its neighbor, bombed and destroyed its infrastructure, slaughtered its citizens. This is a P5 member doing something which we thought we consigned to the history books. It is the era of narrow nationalism now, and it's the era where you badly need all the sinews of the international system, whether you're dealing with pandemics or protectionism or terrorism or climate change. There's another one I've missed out. But you know, these are things which really need to have the international system pulling together. And you know, whether you look at Trump or Modi or Xi or Putin or Boris Johnson or whatever, you've got the era of the narrow nationalist. And this is the very thing that our forefathers after the war, who'd seen the slaughter on the Western Front in the First World War and the carnage in the Second World War, they wanted an international system, Bretton Woods and all these other things, to bind people in. And so that was the next point I wanted to make. I thought you made a very interesting point indeed about development and trade. Of course, they go absolutely hand in hand. This developing countries trading scheme, which is the best in the world now, it's better than anything but arms or a Goa, very, very strong, better than the EPAs, is Britain saying to poor countries, we want to make it easy for you to sell what you can to our country, and we want you to have the value added in your country, and we're prepared to forget about rules of origin, which in other areas have been very damaging. And Stefan mentioned the importance of the poverty focus. I thought the big battle in the Foreign Office would be getting poverty into the title of the white paper. Anyone who's operating in the developed world knows that unless you understand that that is the purpose of British international development policy, you're completely missing the point. And actually, it's quite easy. There weren't that many people who resisted. There were people who resisted it, but there weren't that many. And also, you made the point about not being too pessimistic, because we have decreased the levels of egregious poverty as defined by two-thirds. I thought that was a very good point. On the climate crisis and the anger in the developing world and the concern, for example, about loss and damage in the developed world, I would say we put £60 million pounds into loss and damage. We did it because the... you're looking at me in a significant way. We did it. I don't want to overuse my... we did it because the UAE put in $100 million alongside Germany, I think. But our point about loss and damage, I don't particularly like the finger-pointing nature of the title, but that's a minor point, is that it has to bring in non-traditional donors. You can't just rely upon the classic OECD DAC. You've got to have the Saudis in there and other countries in the UAE, the Gulf. You've got to have Russia, China. You've got to have these other countries in there if it's to work. And you've got to find different sources of finance. Otherwise, it's just Peter robbing Paul. We put in ODA money, but you've got to find other mechanisms for funding and other people to fund. So, you know, maybe it's some sort of maritime fuel levy or something like that. But that is obviously very much work in progress. And finally, how do you work in difficult places? I mean, there's a matrix, isn't there? Ideally, you want to do as much as possible with the government, but you can't countenance corruption. You must have a zero tolerance of corruption, because it's the cancer of development, poisons everything. So ideally, you do as much as possible with the government. If you can't, you do it with local NGOs. If you can't do that, you do it with international NGOs. Remembering always that we work with people and countries, leaderships like British Foreign Office recognition. We don't recognize leaders, because otherwise we get into a mess when there are coups and so on. We recognize countries, and it's an important part of development that we work on issues which affect the poor people in those countries and the people whose standard of living and whose appreciation of the importance of economic development and prosperity, whose fear of conflict, we are on their side in tackling and driving forward the answers to those things.
Thank you, Minister. We have about 35 minutes left to our event, and because of the very interesting audience we have here with lots of accumulated experience, I will somewhat abbreviate our conversation here, but I have just two very brief questions for you. One of them is concerns domestic politics, and I thank you for being so candid about DFID and relationship with the Foreign Office in the recent years. We much appreciate it. The point is, something seems to have changed in the last 2 years. You brought a strong tradition of bipartisanship. Charles already mentioned your remarkable work with Margaret Hodge on illicit finance over the years. And this seems to have affected the way the conversation about the white paper went. You consulted very extensively. You involved not just Margaret, but people like David Davis, Liam Byrne, a lot of individuals across the bench who were part of the conversation. Can you tell us a little bit about how that went, that process of depoliticizing the development conversation, and your hopes for the future? Do you think that this is the new normal, and we're not going to go back to the way development was politicized and became so polarizing over the last 7 or 8 years in the UK?
So, yes, I can. I mean, what I always used to say when we were in opposition before 2010, which used to antagonize my then opposition, now my good friend Douglas Alexander, was I used to say, this isn't a Labour policy or a Tory policy, it's a British policy. And I believe that and we were working very well until Boris came along, to embed into Britain the sense that it wasn't charity. And people continue to say to me, charity begins at home, to which I always say, but it doesn't stop there. But it wasn't charity, it was about British interests. And I would argue every penny that we spend on international development is in Britain's interests that we do, because these egregious, huge differences of wealth and opportunity disfigure our world, and they create very unhappy people who are often prey to the terrorist recruiter. So you know, I would argue that, and it's a British policy, and I took out all the word leadership in the white paper, I think, along with the word tool, which appeared so often. I thought we should take that out. But the point is that if the more that it is a British approach, the more likely it is to be successful. And I hope very much that is the case. I mean, I talk often to David Lammy and Lisa Nandy, and David very helpfully said that their view on the structure of DFID Foreign Office, they were going to look and see how far, I quote, how far Andrew got. Mm. So, you know, that's quite helpful to me in trying to negotiate change ahead of the Chatham House speech. Also, the whole thing is, to be blunt with you, the whole thing is much easier now that David Cameron is back as a Foreign Secretary. Because, I mean, I've worked with him and for him for the last 20 years. And, you know, and on any subject that comes before the Foreign Office, his views often surprise Foreign Office officials. And they make for change. I know exactly what he's going to think about these things because I've worked with him for so long. And he's having him there, particularly as a Foreign Secretary who's been a Prime Minister, gives the position of Foreign Secretary enormous heft and power. And on your point about Margaret Hodge, what happened there is quite instructive because we were both on the back benches. She was running the PAC and she followed David Davis. And none of our politics are the same, of course. But and so she was after dirty money because she was after people evading tax and businesses evading tax. Mm-hmm. I didn't come at it from that angle. I think the revenue has as much power as they need, probably. But I came at it from the point of view that I wanted to stop bent warlords, politicians and corrupt businessmen, ministers in Africa from corruptly stealing wealth, which belonged to those countries. And I wanted to support things like the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, which in our time Britain joined, to try and make sure that this theft was more difficult. And now, of course, Well, and then Margaret and I joined up on that basis, and we once paid state visit a day each to the three crown dependencies, and I don't think till at this point today they've recovered from Margaret Hodges' visit. We tried to tell them that their perception of themselves was not shared outside of those crown dependencies. They needed to make change, and they needed open registers of beneficial ownership, which, in spite of clear commitments given to Margaret and me, and the threat of defeating the government as well on the issue, because we had the people to do so, in spite of all of that, they still haven't fully signed up to any of this, and they've got to do so. So that, I think, is an example of quite a good cross-party initiative. It didn't start from let's do something together, which I don't think is a good basis for all party initiatives. It started from the basis, well, I want to achieve this, you want to achieve that, shall we join forces? And that's really how we tried to do it.
Thank you. And my final question before opening the floor. You mentioned when we were talking about green transition and hybrid financing, I think it was in that context, you mentioned, and I quote, the Saudis should be in there. And this opens up the question of values versus interests, because what you describe in the white paper is clearly an expansion, not away from the traditional OECD states, but as you made the point just a little while ago, that if it's just the usual suspects, it's no longer enough, right? On the other hand, there are serious issues on which the UK is not like-minded in regard to these states. And I'll just give you you don't necessarily have to comment on that in particular, but I'll give you an example recently from the illicit finance front. The United Arab Emirates, which is an ally of the UK in many respects, has just been removed from the grey list of the Financial Action Task Force after having been on that grey list for under 2 years. It is broadly agreed between experts that the UAE didn't do much in order to get out of that grey list. But geopolitically, the imperative is that a state such as the UK have a strong relationship with that Middle Eastern state. So where do values meet interests in practice? That's my question.
Well, I off the top of my head, I think you're slightly unfairly characterizing FATF and the way Britain works with FATF. I think. You see, we do try and get our friends off the grey list. We do try to. We work with them to satisfy the authorities so that they can come off FATF, but equally there are others who go on to it where reasons of national interest would dictate we might try and stop it. We don't do that. We try and work with them to put right the things that got them onto FATF. And I can't remember at the moment why the UAE cleared the hurdle, but I think you may be putting a pejorative reflection on it. I mean, you know, the we are working. When I came back and saw the lack of funding, what I wanted to try and do was to find ways of multiplying the funding. And so, for example, the use of guarantees. I mean, Britain has produced £6 billion of guarantees, all of which has meant people, the World Bank's got, the African Development Bank particularly, which is very inventive in this space. These guarantees, they are sometimes serious multipliers. They're multipliers for us because this does not score as ODA, so it's way above the ODA limits. But what it means is that if you give these guarantees, they can lend, and sometimes they can lend a multiple of the guarantee. The reason why we put so much effort into these insurance pools, which are now paying out both in the Caribbean and in East Africa, is because that is a multiplier. The SDRs, the 4 billion SDRs, which Jeremy agreed could go and fund the two anti-poverty funds of the IMF, so worth £5.3 billion. None of that scores as ODA, but it's all multipliers, getting more money into the international system. And we're also doing it. We're doing joint financing on issues where we agree, so this is part of the answer to your question. So with Gulf states, with the UAE, with Qatar, with Saudi, we're doing these deals where there are geographies where we both want to do things together, and there are issues of climate or humanitarian relief or green finance or whatever else we want to do together. We put our money alongside their money, and we pursue a joint objective. So, you know, it's a sort of bog-off arrangement for the British taxpayers. Buy one, get one free. And it's the same thing for the Saudis. So, you know, I think that's a very good thing to do. Now, I am conscious that, we all remember Jamal Khashoggi and all these things, but the point is, here we are working in a targeted way to do good and to pursue British objectives. We're working with them on issues where we have a common view and in geographies where we both want to help. And, you know, I will be going to China shortly to talk to people in development in China. We did a lot more of this back in 2010, 2011, 2012. Indeed, we, before the Busan Aid Effectiveness Conference, we got both China and India into the outer ring of the OECD DAC in the teeth of American opposition to it. But Britain managed to agree that and negotiate it. So I'm going there to see what we can do together on China in a very hostile environment politically at the moment. And, you know, people say, why do we uniquely have an embassy in Tehran when other Western countries don't? And the answer to all those questions is the same. You know, we have to do business with these countries. If we refuse, as some of my parliamentary colleagues want us, to have anything to do with China, you know, how do we negotiate serious climate agreements? How do we make progress on things that we and they want to progress? How do we make the international system, what's left of it, work at all? And that, my answer is, you know, you have to have links and drive forward on issues which matter to them and matter to us and where we need to speak. And, you know, the intelligence services of all these countries have always had back channels to each other. Let's be sensible and pragmatic.
Thank you, Minister. And on that note, we're going to open the floor to questions. I would ask the members of the audience to raise your hand. Please identify yourself and keep your question as brief as you can, so that we can get as many questions as possible. Nairi?
Yes.
Sorry. Someone's coming. Just a second.
Nairi Woods, thanks a lot. Great panel discussion. A quick question. The emphasis on sweating the balance sheets of the multilaterals is terrific, expanding the SDRs, etc. Which powerful countries most need persuading of that case? Who's in the way? You know, the SDRs have still not made their way into the poverty fund at the IMF, and the traditionally some big shareholders in the bank have resisted the fantastic measures that you were talking about. So where is it we should put our efforts in persuading other governments? Which ones do you think we should be trying to persuade?
So that's to me, isn't it, Nairi?
Yeah.
So
shall we pick up three?
Yes. Do you want to get some?
Nick Westcott.
Thank you, Nick Westcott, SOAS now. You hinted yourself, Minister, that conflict is the one thing that hinders development, increases poverty faster than anything else. How much of our aid budget is going to continue to be devoted to conflict prevention? And how are we going to do it now? As you said, the multilateral system is decaying, and that was the instrument we tended to use in the past. How are we going to do it now? Thank you.
Thank you. And we have two questions here. Peter Leon, and then someone there on the back. One here.
Thanks. Peter Leon, question for the minister, and then a very quick one for Stefan, which you'll find very easy, I think. To the minister, you talked about the G20, and I just want to ask you about Zambia, because that seems to me to epitomize the problems with the G20 debt arrangement, where China has not really come to the party properly. Zambia's got $13 billion of debt, spending 39% of its budget on debt servicing as a result of what happened under the Lungu administration. So my question is the model working satisfactorily, and where do you see it headed? My question, Stefan, is you talk about fragile states in West Africa. How does one address the issue of Wagner and what's now replaced it and Russia in the ECOWAS region?
Thank you. And the question over there.
Hi, I'm Peter Evans, a freelancer and part of the DFID brain drain, I guess. I hope I can say brain. I just wanted to ask you about the pecking order of issues in the white paper. and the mention of David Cameron and the reassurance of having him or working with him again, and open societies and democratic governance and the sort of the value-focused offer. Because the kind of compromises that Stefan mentioned about having to work with very difficult partners who don't necessarily share our values, it does put a strain on that part of our package. I just wondered how you sort of circle the square or square the circle in terms of all those things and open societies. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
So, first of all, to Nari, who very generously agreed to be part of my advisory team, and the white paper owes an awful lot to the first meeting of the advisory team, which helped us to frame it, the sort of chapter headings. A lot of them came out of that. So thank you very much indeed for that. I had a meeting with the governor of the bank about the SDRs, because SDRs affect different economies in different ways. So our use of the SDRs, I have to be careful I get this right, affects a sort of contingent liability on the national balance sheet for which the Bank of England are responsible. And so we've asked him, and actually he was kind enough to say that he wasn't on top of this, you know, go away and do some more work on it and come back to us. But we are trying to press for much greater use of the SDRs, and Jeremy Hunt has engaged seriously with us on this, trying to get better use of them. And you know, the French say that they want to use 40% of their SDRs, and we've used 20% of ours, and it would be very good if we could get some more to the African Development Bank. The other countries are prepared to try and do that. It would be a very good financing system. But, you know, I noticed the French haven't actually done it yet. And so there are technical difficulties, and we're working to try and deal with that. In your question about which countries need to do more, I mean, I think all countries need to. There's a problem with the states, which is their electoral cycle at the moment, and Congress, of course. But everyone needs to pull together in the international system and play their part. And it is much more difficult now for the reasons that I set out. Nick and SOAS and conflict. I mean, conflict is development in reverse, as a very great professor at this university once said. And so what we're trying to do is to stop, and policy is directed at all three of these things. Stop conflict starting. Once it's started, bring it to a conclusion. And once it's over, try and reconcile people. And it is unbelievably difficult. In the white paper, there are the tools for doing some of this, one of which is the Resilience and Adaptation Fund, which I talked about in my opening remarks. BII is specifically charged to do more in smaller, poorer countries and conflict-affected countries. It is very, very difficult. And, of course, they need a bit of scale in order to wash their face. So, you know, sometimes there are funds which can be in different countries. One fund, one BII fund, and it can operate in a number of different ways with a local manager, with an overall number of projects. So, you know, they are very inventive, and we are looking very carefully at that. On the Refusnik from DFID, whose return we very much want, you know, I mean, I was in Zambia and was, you know, at the time when they were on the cusp, and then they sort of got what they needed from the IMF. And since when, as you rightly say, it's gone backwards. I mean, the problem here is that the debt we are dealing with, we don't want to get into a position where all the enthusiasm for the debt forgiveness and HIPIC, which drove big change, and then our opponents of development cynically say, well, you know, you've done all that, and now they've all borrowed again, and they're indebted again, and we're gone back to square one, which would be very damaging for the aims that all of us in this room share. So I think it's important to recognise that the debt is different this time. You know, it's not debt like it was before. It's debt to China. It's debt to Middle Eastern countries particularly. And the G20 is not sufficient, but I think there are ways of enhancing the G20 mechanisms. And we have to do more. We are fortunately aided by the fact that, and this is the reason why markets around the world have gone up in the last couple of months, that it looks as though we got on top of inflation. The Chancellor of Exchequer announced today that in the second quarter of this year, we will be back below 2% inflation in Britain, which is a very, very significant achievement. So that makes the whole business slightly more benign, that we're not, because we've seen countries in Africa paying four times as much in interest, and sometimes more than that, I think, in interest over recent months as a result. Final question about values that you made. I mean, you know, I was in Ethiopia where there is a real danger of a famine 40 years on from, you know, Live Aid and Michael Burke and Bob Geldof and so on. There's a real danger. I managed to go up and see for myself. I looked through the records in a health center so I could see what the trend was on the ground. It's very, very frightening indeed. And of course, we don't have the ability, which we had back to 40 years ago, to bring relief through Sudan, because Sudan is up in flames. And I would describe the position there as a football has been kicked towards a plate glass window. It's in flight. We can deflect it if we take the action now, and we are, I hope, going to take the action. But if we don't take the action, it will smash the plate glass window. And there is an example of a country where we need urgently to provide humanitarian help. We don't agree with... Ethiopia is a good friend of Britain and ally of Britain in some respects. We don't agree with quite a lot of what they do, but we need to keep our eye focused on the end game. And, you know, even in a country like Eritrea, with which we have atrocious relations, we've just kicked out their ambassador and they won't have ours, you know, there is good stuff happening through the multilateral system, and Britain supports that.
Thank you. Emily, and then Stefan, if we could be relatively brief so we can get another round of questions.
So perhaps, Minister, when you come back with the second round of answers, I was wondering what your advice would be for whichever government gets in terms of just making the case for development and internationalism, and where actually the pinch points are, and what making sure that we can sustain this at home. What would your sort of top three pieces of advice be to whoever inherits this mantle?
Briefly.
No, I'll do the end.
Okay.
So, you know, I very unfairly was asked, you know, we have a Minister for International Development and for Africa in the room, Minister of the Crown, and I should answer what we do with Wagner. But I will want to say two very quick points on that is, you know, taking into account all the things the Minister was saying, you know, Wagner doesn't come out simply, doesn't appear simply out of nothing. And it's something that, you know, an obsession with stability, for example, in West Africa, and by another geopolitical power, or a couple of them, obsessed with stability is definitely one of the big sources of the instability now. A kind of an obsession to keep the status quo, to keep it as it is, maybe doing sometimes aid as well at the process, but actually with an obsession with the status quo in these countries gets us to where the breeding ground. As seen from the UK, I don't think, you know, we are the ones that will be able to contain it. But I do think that I still worry about that we're not learning enough from past episodes where it happened also in our spaces, in the places where we were very active. For example, I do regret, and maybe it's happening now, but post-Afghanistan, there is no serious learning, not just on the conflict side, but actually also on the development side of how it is that places where billions and billions and billions and billions of aid went, development didn't do it. And there is a need for doing that. We need to learn, not least because the world is a very complicated place now. And I think it is an important thing, I think, needs to happen internally in FCDO as well, to really take these lessons and think, okay, but what is it that we maybe can do so that actually when we come to Wagner, we have not a recipe, but at least some entry points beyond general things, as long as it's development. Yes, we know development tends to avoid conflict, but that's not where we are now. How do we rebuild and get populations to trust outsiders and governments and whatever? And so there's work to be done, and definitely learning is central to it.
Thank you, Stefan. And we're going to open the floor for another final round of questions. Again, please introduce yourself, be very brief, and then we'll come back to the minister for a final set of answers. gentleman over there.
Thank you. Michael Green, I'm a DPhil student here. I have a question about multilateral body governance, which has a narrow part and a broad part. So narrowly, I was wondering if the minister has any thoughts on the proposal by Brad Setzer at the Council on Foreign Relations for the World Bank to be able to issue SDR-denominated bonds to really stretch its balance sheet, which could lead to much bigger flows than the even like $4 billion that he mentioned with reduced capital requirements. And secondly, and more broadly, I realize that's quite technical, if he or anyone on the panel has thoughts about governance changes in the governance of these multilateral bodies. I'm thinking in particular about the head of the World Bank being American and the IMF being European, and also voting rights in terms of the shareholders thereof. Thanks.
Very much. Thank you. That's a good question. In the back.
Hello, my name is George Carrick-Jones. I'm a researcher on the Climate Compatible Growth Programme, generously funded by the FCDO. I have a question about data, and I suppose the minister mentioned that the multiplying funding is obviously a core aim, but it's something that's very, very hard to do on the ground without good quality data upon risk and projects, particularly when it comes to adaptation and resilience. A lot of these are locally deployed projects where it isn't really the infrastructure for monitoring and evaluation at the moment. And that's something that I haven't seen much of in terms of financial sector deepening, either through FSD Africa or otherwise. So I'm wondering if that's something the minister could see being a further priority and how that might happen.
Charles?
A couple of questions from the online audience. One relates to the question.
Just a second, Charles. I'm not sure if we can hear you.
Thank you. A couple of questions from the online audience. One relates to one we've had already about the what needs to happen to international organisations and extending it to the UN family of organisations. What needs to be done about reforming international organisations beyond the Bretton Woods organisations to the UN family in a complex multipolar world? That's from Mark Dick. And Francis Guy asks, does the excellent commitments to climate finance, will they inevitably come at the expense of money going into poverty alleviation?
Thank you, Charles. And I should add that our online audience following us is roughly double the one that you see in the room. So is there a final question or two? Or there's a question here. Again, if you could introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm Adam Sparks. I'm a master's student here at the Department of International Development. Minister, I'm grateful for your comments on the crown dependencies. I grew up in Guernsey, and at the time that you and Margaret visited regarding beneficial ownership, I remember the destitution in the office that I interned at the States of Guernsey. But you're entirely right that the crown dependencies have been very slow to implement beneficial ownership registries. But do you think that crown dependency example is representative of the UK? And I'm thinking in particular of the City of London more broadly. So over the summer, I worked with the Indonesian Taxation Authority, and they have real trouble in doing domestic revenue mobilization. When they try to initiate taxation investigations, it's particularly difficult to get information from HMRC. So I'm wondering what sort of cost is there to the city if you did pursue a policy that challenges its preeminence as a global financial center?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Minister. Is there anything that you'd like to address before I give the word to the Minister? The floor is yours.
Right. Is this the last round?
Yes, it is.
So I'm just looking at the time to check.
I think you have to leave in 6 minutes.
Right.
Just about. We were told.
I was worried about keeping them too long.
No, please.
So look, on the last point you make, I'm pleased that our visit had an impact in Guernsey. I mean, the problem with this whole business, there's a chap called Oliver Bullock who writes very good books on this, and they're well worth reading. Normally, if I read his book, like Stefan's book, I pick it up. You can't put it down. It's so good. But the point is that the baddies have all the best tunes. You see, the baddies can employ the best lawyers, the best accountants, the best people, and the government is like the PBI, the poor bloody infantry. They're following behind, trying to keep up and catch up. And the law, when we change the laws, we've had a number of economic reform and corruption bills. We're normally closing things, and then the new loopholes are found by these clever people who advise. And it's a very difficult situation. And Basically, we are making some progress, and open registers, we will get there. There's been a big change in America, actually, towards, they're not open registers, but there's a big change in terms of transparency. It's transparency we have to go after, because that is how you, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And the horrific figure is that 40% of all the money laundering goes through London or overseas territories or CDs, you know, which means we've got questions to answer on this, and we must get better. And I've been winding up the Foreign Secretary to do more on illicit finance, because he was the bloke who did the G8 summit, which imposed open registers on Britain, and you know, they haven't worked as well as they should because of the nature of Companies House, which is a library and not an investigating effort. But we've now changed the law on that, and they will be doing investigations. And you know, when these cases happen, like the one you described from Indonesia, make sure ministers know, because you know, the HMRC is we have people around the world exporting the HMRC's skills to show other countries how to run their revenue services. Making sure we know so we can have a look at it, and the Indonesia desk at the Foreign Office can have a look at it and see what we can do to help is very important. The person who asked the question about whether or not climate finance is at the expense of poverty alleviation, I think that was the question. I don't believe it is, and I believe, like a Venn diagram, there's an enormous middle bit. And you know, the Prime Minister announced that from 2019 we would increase our the amount of money we were spending each year from 500 million to 1.5 billion on adaptation. We have the commitment to 11.6 billion on climate funding by 2026. You know, there's an awful lot of stuff that's in the middle of the Venn diagram, which I think prevents us from falling into the trap which you identified. Reforming international organizations. I mean, this is terribly difficult, of course, because the UN is basically built on the post-World War II settlement. Britain has made it clear we think that the Security Council needs to be expanded. We think that Brazil and South Africa, Nigeria, Germany, we think it needs to be expanded. It's incredibly difficult, and of course it's something which Secretary-General will only embrace in their second term of office, because it's going to create a lot of difficulty. And there are people who've made a lifetime career at the UN in blocking change. So it is very difficult. And you know, when I was in opposition, I wrote a pamphlet called The Failure to Protect, about the responsibility to protect, which ought to be one of the easiest things to change, but it hasn't really changed, to be honest. Data. I completely agree. I thought you were a bit cruel to FSD Africa, which is an absolutely brilliant organization and doing real work to transform the financial systems in countries, doing really well. But the point about data is absolutely critical. In the white paper, there's good stuff on digital and research and science and data and so on, which if you've probably already seen it, but if you haven't, do look, because I think it's quite powerful. And if you have ideas of how we can drive that forward, please do let us know. Multilateral governance, SDR-denominated bonds, and the governance of the World Bank. I mean, I think all these things we need to try and drive forward. They're more difficult in the current context, but the powerful lead of the IMF, the fact we've got a chancellor in London who's very interested in this stuff, the Bank of England, you know, everyone needs to do more. And if we could get an SDR-denominated bond, I think that would be terrific. But there are difficulties in achieving that. We are looking at all these things. And because we've got this very brilliant team in Washington, which AJ Banger uses to some extent as a bit of a think tank, we are able to drive these things forward. On the very good point you made about the governance of the World Bank, I mean, it is ridiculous, really, that it shouldn't be done on merit. And back in 2012, when Bob Zelic left, many of us tried very hard to subvert the current system, but it survived. And you know, if the Americans don't put money in, which they're threatening not to do at the moment, I mean, they're not threatening not to do, but it's got to get through Congress. you know, that will undermine the American hegemony in the World Bank. And not just in the World Bank, because, of course, they always run the World Food Programme and UNICEF and so on. So I disagree with this. I think it should be done on merit. You've got to find a comprehensive way of deciding. And, of course, when the Chinese bank, which we have a vice presidency of it, Danny Alexander is one of the vice presidents there, it's doing very well. It started really because of the failures of governance, which you mentioned on the World Bank. It's doing very well. The Americans were furious with us when we agreed to be a core shareholder. But actually, you know, it's a proper multilateral bank and it's governed in all the right sort of ways. Finally, two things. On Wagner and France and values and so on, I mean, it's extraordinary that France, you know, France is in a terrible position in Africa now. We've seen and often it is because of the relationship when they decolonize, you know, they having deals which are out of date on access to mineral wealth and in particular the nuclear mineral wealth, uranium. So the relationship has gone badly wrong, not in our interest, in my view. When I was in DFID, we worked against the Russians and the French and the Chinese in Africa. We now work with the French much more, and I think that's the right thing to do. And it's extraordinary, too, because Macron, I think, is by far the most friendly to Africa and understanding. He's a different generation from the older people. But a real understanding when he had his summit in with the Indians in Paris last year. I heard him speak on two occasions. I thought with real depth of understanding. So it's a tragedy in a sense that it's on his watch that this has happened. But in the end, it's values, it's working together, it's localism, it's showing people that our values are superior to the values of the Russians and the Chinese. And also doing some of the good things. There are a few tiny good things that Wagner, in theory, asserts that it does. I mean, everything Wagner does is terrible. And their record in Africa of human rights abuse and pillage is absolutely appalling. But, you know, if other countries who have better values provide some security for things that matter in these countries, that is something which we should do more to explore. And finally, making the case for development. If it's all party, it's easier. I mean, we came very close to defeating the government, to defeating Johnson on the 0.7, very close. If the Speaker had called the amendment to the bill, the ARIA bill, which spent ODA money, and the amendment's very simple, but I think rather clever. It said that if the government doesn't spend at 0.7, anything between what it spends, i.e. 0.5 and 0.7, it has to spend through this Innovation Act, which spent ODA money. And the Speaker very nearly called it. Had he called it, it would have been an epic moment, because it would have been the House of Commons, members of Parliament, banding together and stopping the executive cutting the 0.7. And it would have humiliated the government, because it would have been a moral point, really, that the House of Commons was making. Anyway, he didn't call the amendment, and there we are. But the point is that would have been a very, very good sign indeed, and would have driven it forward. And in the end, you know, we have set up this new platform called UCDEV, which is joint between the government and the civil society. And civil society are putting money into it, the government's putting money into it. There are rules which have to be carefully kept, because you can't have the government campaigning, in a way that appears to take electoral advantage, for example. But the UCDEV and this new platform, as we get it going, it's beginning to move now. The new foreign secretary is very enthusiastic about it. That will be very helpful as well. But in the end, standing up for it. I say to people, you know, when you're at the bus stop or in the pub, or indeed at the Heathrow security one day, when I heard someone say behind, "That's the geezer that gives all our money to India," I heard them say. arguing the toss. And when people say, "Well, charity begins at home," say, yes, it does, but it doesn't end there. You know, I think we have to stand up for this. The thing I'm most proud about in my government career is being part of a government that, in spite of the austerity that was then faced by Britain and the fact that budgets were being cut everywhere in 2010, George Osborne, David Cameron, they stood by the promise to the poorest people in the world, and they brought in the 0.7. It wasn't a Labour government that did it. It was the coalition, and it was the Conservative leadership of David Cameron and George Osborne, which honoured that pledge, something that Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, that a pledge to the poorest people in the world is a sacred thing. You know, they did it, and I honour them for that, and I'm enormously proud to have been a member of an administration that did that, and very ashamed that it was thrown back some years later.
Thank you, Minister. It's been a privilege to welcome you back to the Oxford Martin School. Thank you to the Minister and Emily Jones and Stefan Durkin for this really, really great event. Please join me in thanking the speaker.